first. So, you're a lawyer? She looks at Meredith.
Yes, Meredith says, though I just took a sabbatical.
I cringe at the term, wondering why she didn't call it a leave of absence, like she has before, as Sophie turns to me. And you're a teacher? She asks.
Yes, I teach the first grade.
How did you know that? From Facebook?
Sophie shakes her head and says, No, your mom told me the last time she wrote.
And when was that? I ask, uncertain of the timing or frequency of their communication, and wondering if Mom's been in touch about a December visit.
Oh, several years back, she says. Maybe 2010 or 11? I can't recall exactly.
How is she doing?
Sophie's brow furrows with concern.
She's fine, I say. She got her real estate license.
Sophie says, a British response that I've never been able to decipher. Does it mean, oh, really? Or, tell me more? Or, I already knew that.
And I guess you heard our parents got a divorce, I say.
Sophie drops her eyes as she says yes, she knew that.
I'm so sorry, she adds. For some inexplicable reason, I feel the urge to make it worse.
Yeah, Mom couldn't deal with Dad's drinking. He was on the wagon until everything fell apart.
Okay, then, Meredith says in a brisk, upbeat voice. Enough of that.
I smile, then say to no one in particular.
Okay, Meredith says enough of that.
I just think we can find more cheerful things to discuss, Meredith says under her breath. I raise my brows, thinking, oh, like the last time we all saw each other? At Daniel's funeral, perhaps?
Anyway, she sends her best, Meredith says, which I'm pretty sure is a lie, unless she happened to talk to Mom this afternoon while I was napping.
Tell her I said hello, too. Sophie smiles and nods, but can't mask her pained, pitying look.
I know it well. It was the way so many people looked at me for so long after the accident, and feel a rush of annoyance. Though I know it's not fair. How else do I expect her to look right now? And would I really want her to not feel pity?
Silently granting that she is in a lose-lose situation, I pluck a piece of ropey serrano ham from her appetizer spread, pop it into my mouth, and change the subject.
So, I say, still chewing, are you married, Sophie?
Meredith interjects with a high, nervous laugh, then says,
Well, that's a little direct.
Oh, it's fine, Sophie says, as I recall one of her letters to Mom about a year after Daniel's death. It was several pages long, both front and back, and written in the most beautiful handwriting, covering every subject imaginable, from her family to her residency to her travels. But there was not one single mention of her romantic situation, only an awkward paragraph about how she still thought of Daniel every single day. I remember folding it back up and thinking this should be a given, hardly worth mentioning, and that this seemed to be a sign that she was seeing someone. In any event, she seems perfectly comfortable with my question now.
I'm actually divorced, but we had a good run. Almost 10 years.
I'm sorry, Meredith says, bowing her head. At least he didn't die, I think.
Thank you, Sophie says. It was hard. But I'm in a good place now.
I imagine her saying these same words to her ex-husband about Daniel, and feel another irrational wave of resentment at just how adept she is at getting over big wounds.
Do you have kids? Meredith asks.
Yes, Sophie says, smiling. I have a 7-year-old son, Calvin.
Oh, yes, I think I saw him on your Facebook page.
She smiles, nods, and says, Yes, that's him.
That's a cute name, Meredith says, as I think that I can't picture my brother going for a name like Calvin. But frankly, I can't picture Daniel with Sophie at all anymore, even when I try to adjust his age in my mind, a difficult thing to do. I just don't see them together as she is now.
Thank you. He's a sweet boy, Sophie says, perking up the way parents so often do when the subject turns to their kids.
Do you have children?
I have a daughter, Harper. She's 4. Meredith replies, a look of pride flickering across her face.
Oh, that's a great age, Sophie says.
Meredith nods her agreement, then says, Josie's planning on having a baby soon, too. I look at her, surprised, as Sophie asks me, Oh, are you pregnant? No, I say. I'm planning to do it via donor insemination, soon. Sophie cocks her head to the side, giving me a look that can only be interpreted as one of respect.
That's marvelous. Good for you, she says.
Thank you, I say. I'm really excited.
You should be,
she says, as we segue into a lively conversation about pregnancy, childbirth, and motherhood. I wonder how long it will be before one of us finally brings up Daniel. Nearly an hour later, we are seated in a cozy corner booth at Café Luxembourg, a bustling bistro where Sophie seems to be a regular. She orders another bottle of wine, which I hope will facilitate a deeper conversation. But by the time our entrees arrive at the table, Daniel's name still has yet to be uttered. I decide that I can't wait another moment. Searching for my opening, I find it when Meredith compliments Sophie's wine selection.
I'm glad you like it, she replies. I actually don't know much about wine, but I've been to this particular vineyard.
You don't know much about wine? That's surprising. Daniel used to brag about how worldly you were, I say, thinking that wine selection seems to fall squarely into that purview. She smiles and says,
I think he confused my accent with worldliness. I was actually quite green when I met Daniel.
Yeah, right, I say, feeling oddly jubilant that I finally got her to say his name.
I was, she insists.
I roll my eyes and laugh, but not unkindly.
Come on, Sophie, you were a Yale medical student. And didn't you go to Oxford and some fancy boarding school before that?
Yes, she says, pushing a carrot with a tine of her fork. But I was only a day student.
Oh, a day student, I smile. Well, that changes everything.
Sophie laughs at herself, but then grows earnest.
Truly, I grew up in much the same way that you did, very comfortably, but not lavishly.
She hesitates, then adds, I loved your family home, and Atlanta is such a beautiful city, urban in some ways, yet so green and lush. You really had an idyllic life.
She stops abruptly, looking slightly mortified.
I mean, that's what I remember thinking when I was there. You know, with Daniel.
Her voice trails off as her face reddens and she looks down at her plate.
In other words, when she visited the first time, not when she came back for the funeral. It is so awkward that I can't help feeling sorry for her and reach out to touch her arm. We know what you meant. I say, speaking for my sister, too, as I wonder, for really the first time, about how it all unfolded for her.
Where were you when you found out? I say, chasing the question with a gulp of wine.
Sophie takes a measured breath, then another. I was on my way to Royal Albert Hall with my grandmother. We were going to the carols by candlelight, our little tradition.
She pauses and bites her lip. A faraway look in her eye.
My mobile rang. I saw Daniel's name and was so excited to hear from him. I'd been gushing about him to Gran and had been trying to call him since I landed that morning. But it wasn't Daniel, of course, she says. It was his friend, Nolan.
My eyes still on Sophie, I nod and point to my sister.
That's Meredith's husband.
Sophie looks surprised.
Is it? She asks.
My mom didn't tell you that?
I ask, knowing that she must have, and wanting to call Sophie out on forgetting.
Maybe she did, come to think of it, she says, now looking at Meredith.
That's so nice, for your family.
I watch Meredith tense up, her eyes becoming expressionless, almost steely.
Yes, we got married and moved into our family home.
Her voice trails off.
It really is a beautiful home, Sophie says, and I just love Atlanta. Do you think you would have lived there? I ask. If you had married Daniel? Sophie gazes back at me, blinking. She opens her mouth, starts to answer, then stops, as if the thought has never really occurred to her, one way or the other. I don't know, she says, blinking back at me. Well, I press, do you think you would have married Daniel? A painful silence follows, but I refuse to speak first, unwilling to offer her an out. I am relieved that Meredith doesn't either. Oh, Josie, Sophie finally says, her voice and expression laden with guilt. I just don't know the answer to that. There are so many variables. Such as? I ask. Such as our residencies, whether we would have matched at the same place, then our fellowships. We were so young, and those were grueling years. But did you love him? I ask, thinking there's really only one variable that should matter. Yes, I loved him, but I just don't know. Her answer, along with the uneasy look on her face, confirms my hunch. Although I appreciate her honesty, I can't help feeling betrayed on Daniel's behalf. And part of me is tempted to shout, "How dare you not tell us that our brother was the love of your life, the best person you've ever known, and that you've never gotten over the loss?" I glance at Meredith and can tell in an instant that she feels the same, which is somehow reassuring. It occurs to me that as different as we are in our behavior and decisions, our most basic knee-jerk emotional reactions to really big things are often remarkably similar. And it is in these moments that I am most grateful for my sister. Meredith clears her throat, then picks up my interrogation where I left off, her feelings of decorum apparently having dissipated. The night you flew back to London, right before the accident, Daniel sat in the kitchen and talked to Mom about you. Did she ever tell you about that conversation? Sophie shakes her head and gives a terrible answer once again. Maybe. I don't recall for certain. My sister raises her chin and continues, her voice strong and clear. Well, I'll tell you what he said. He said you were the most incredible person he'd ever met, and that he wanted to marry you for a lot of reasons, including that he knew you'd be a fabulous mother. Goodness, that's so incredibly sweet, Sophie says, finally looking mournful. Yes, Meredith says, and I think that's why you have remained so important to our mother. You're a connection to him. Her voice cracks, so I finish where she left off. I guess we just want to know if you really and truly loved him, I say, giving her one last chance. That it wasn't just some passing romance. Sophie shivers, pulling her cashmere wrap more tightly around her shoulders, taking her time answering. Yes, I did love him. It's just hard. It's hard for me to really remember that time. So much life has happened since. Yes, for everyone. But Daniel, I say, wanting to shame her. It seems to work as she nods and adjusts her wrap again. Deep down, I know I'm not being fair. It's not Sophie's fault that Daniel died and she lived. I can also tell that she is trying her best. It just so happens that her best sort of sucks. So I attempt one last angle. Was your ex-husband much like Daniel? I ask. It feels like a softball, given that the marriage ended. An easy way for her to tell us how much better Daniel was. In some ways, she says, but not really. Is he American? A doctor? Meredith asks. Yes, and yes, Sophie says, but he's not a surgeon like Daniel wanted to be. What is he? A dermatologist, she says. And the stereotypes of those specialties really fit. He's much less intense than Daniel was. More outgoing. Daniel was smarter. I nod thinking, damn right he was. She shrugs and finishes. I don't know. They're very different people. Was he jealous of Daniel? I ask, instantly realizing how ridiculous the question sounds. I mean, of your relationship?
No, Todd's not wired like that. He doesn't really get jealous. He's not the sensitive type. Hence, our divorce, perhaps.
She laughs nervously.
My boyfriend before Todd was more jealous, I think.
Of how much you love Daniel?
Yes, she says. Finally, I think, a satisfying answer.
Are you dating anyone now? Meredith asks.
I take a final bite of my fillet, only mildly curious about Sophie's answer, and for some reason fully expecting it to be no. But when I look up, I watch her face come to life, even more so than when we asked about Calvin. She tells us yes, there is someone.
Is he a doctor too? Meredith says.
She, Sophie says. And no, she's a writer. She goes on to eagerly explain how they met at some yoga retreat in Arizona, but I mostly tune her out, exchanging a glance with Meredith. It is a fleeting one, but I am now positive we feel the same. That we're totally over this evening and Sophie, and especially her love for someone who isn't our brother, whether a man or a woman. Sure enough, during the next pause in the conversation, Meredith cranes her neck to signal the waitress for our bill, then presses her palm to her lips, in what I can tell is a completely fake yawn.
Oh, listen to me, Sophie says, still smiling. I'm so sorry for prattling on like this.
It's fine, Meredith says. We're really happy for you. Right, Josie?
Yes, of course, I say. Very happy for you.
But it is getting late, and Josie has an early flight, Mare lies.
Yes, a very early flight, I say, locking eyes with my sister, unable to think of a single time I have loved her more.
Chapter 28 Meredith. Well, I didn't see that one coming, I say after a virtually silent cab ride home. I carefully remove my shoes and hang up my coat as I make the decision not to mention Josie's boots. Hell, she can sleep in them tonight for all I care at the moment. Yeah, me either. I mean, I knew she had moved on, but damn. Looking glum, Josie strides over to the sofa and collapses onto it. It was like he meant nothing to her. That's not necessarily true, I say as I wash my hands at the kitchen sink. We don't know that she didn't love him deeply. She could have been as committed as he was at the time. Okay, but did you get that feeling? Josie asks. Because I didn't. I mean, she didn't even mention his name until we got to the restaurant. It just felt like she moved on, like, a couple of months later. Yeah, but she just gave us the Cliff Notes version of her life. She did say that one ex was jealous of Daniel. I mean, she could have been heartbroken for years. Well, it would have been nice to hear that, Josie says. I nod again, silently noting that irony that it would have been nice to hear a lot of things from my own sister over the years, too. It would have been nice to discuss our feelings, or visit the cemetery together, or acknowledge Daniel's birthdays, and all the painful anniversaries of his death. But I stick to a more constructive point, and one I've come to learn well in my own life. It's impossible to understand someone else's relationship. They seemed very happy together, and maybe we need to focus on that, the fact that Daniel was happy when he died. She would have broken his heart, Josie says. Probably so, I agree. Josie sighs a deep frown on her face. So, did you really tell Mom we were having dinner with her? I shake my head. I knew it, she says. Should we tell her? I shrug, having already asked myself this question several times since we left the restaurant. We should probably tell her we saw her, but skip the details. Josie nods in agreement. It would upset her more than us. For sure. Sophie's been a symbol to her, or at least a comfort. Think about the stories she always tells about that visit, and her last talk with Daniel at the kitchen table. She loves knowing that Daniel was truly happy and deeply in love, that he experienced the sweetness of that. Even if he loved her way more than she loved him, Josie says. Even if, I say, my mind drifting to Nolan again, wondering if that isn't the happier place to be, the one loving more. Do you want a cup of tea or a decaf? She shakes her head. No, but I'll take some bourbon or something. Is there any hard stuff here? Yep, you're in luck, I say, standing on an acrylic stepladder to reach the cabinet where Ellen keeps her liquor. I pull down a bottle of Widow Jane whiskey, along with a rocks glass. Then on second thought, I grab another glass for me, pour about 2 shots in each, then toss in some cubes of ice from the freezer. God, this is depressing, I say, walking over to the sofa and handing her one of the glasses before I sit down beside her. I mean, what are we doing here anyway? Well, you're here on a sabbatical, she says. Remember? Yeah, yeah, I say. You know what I mean. Look at us. Here we are, 15 years later, all screwed up and begrudging someone else her happiness. Maybe we just need to move on. Josie kicks her boots off, leaving them sprawled under the coffee table, then takes a long drink. She makes a face, puts down her glass, and nods. Yeah, I know. We really do. That's what I was sort of trying to say earlier, when I said that all of our problems seem related to Daniel. It just feels like we've never really gotten over the loss, the way Sophie did. I nod. Yeah, but you can't really compare a short romance, even an intense one, to a relationship with a sibling. True, she says, her face twisting into an expression of deep, profound sadness. You really can't. A long moment of silence passes before she says my name, then turns to face me, leaning on one arm of the sofa. Yeah, I say, looking at her. I need to tell you something. She frowns, staring down at her hands clasped in her lap. Okay, I say, turning to sit sideways, facing her. It's the thing I came here to tell you. About Daniel, she says, glancing up at me with a worried expression. Feeling suddenly cold, I pull Ellen's nubby throw blanket from the back of the sofa and drape it over our legs. What is it? I say. Josie's big blue eyes grow glassy, her lower lip quivering. It conjures a memory of how she used to cry on demand, just to get me in trouble. But this time, I can tell it's sincere. She's truly on the verge of tears, and I feel the sudden urge to protect her, reaching for her hands. She breathes in and out for what feels like a full minute, all the while holding my gaze and hands. Then she opens her mouth and starts to tell me a story. A story about the night Daniel died, of her getting wasted at 5 paces, of someone from the bar calling Daniel to come pick her up, take her home. There are more details, most of them trivial, but I have trouble following them all. No, I finally say, letting go of her hands, shaking my head. That isn't what happened. He was going out to get a burger. That's what he told Mom. He lied to Mom. He was just covering for me, Josie says, her face starting to contort in a valiant but unsuccessful attempt not to cry. Tears spill down her cheeks as she continues. He was on his way to get me. But that's just a theory, I say, my heart starting to race. Right? I mean, how would you know that he was coming to get you? He died before he got there. He could have been going to get a burger, right? She doesn't reply or move a muscle, not even to wipe her tears. Josie, I demand. You don't know that for sure. Do you? Yes, she whispers.
I do, actually.
But how? I say.
I can't tell you how, she says.
Why not? I say, becoming more frantic and angry.
Because I promised someone I wouldn't.
I kick the blanket off my legs, then stand, pacing in front of the coffee table. What do you mean you can't tell me how you know that? You drop a bomb like this and then pull some Woodward and Bernstein bullshit? Josie covers her face with her hands, mumbling again that she can't, that she promised. He was our brother, Josie, I say, wishing I hadn't used the past tense, when he will always be our brother. You're telling me crucial details about the night our brother died, and you're worried about a promise you made to someone else? Who was it? Shauna? I shout.
No,
she says through sobs.
It wasn't Shauna!
Then who? She shakes her head, looking pained and panicked and desperate. And suddenly, just like that, I know who she's protecting.
Nolan,
I whisper, my heart racing, my head spinning. Nolan called Daniel that night to come get you. It is a statement, not a question, and she doesn't deny it. So, I say, my voice calm and restrained, the opposite of the way I feel inside. What you're telling me is that my sister and my husband have been keeping this secret from me for 15 fucking years. I didn't know for sure, Josie says, wiping away tears. Until last weekend. I don't believe you. And besides, clearly Nolan did, I say. Nolan must have known that he called Daniel to come get you. Please don't tell him I told you, she says. I think he wanted to tell you himself. Fuck him! I spit out the words with as much venom as possible, my disbelief morphing into rage. And fuck you, too! Meredith, she says. Please! Talk about a betrayal, I say, as Josie begins to bawl and beg. The sound of her gurgling sobs, the sight of her face glistening with snot and tears, only makes me hate her. I pick up one of her boots and throw it as hard as I can. It hits the wall, the heel leaving a black mark. And what part of take off your fucking shoes when you're in the fucking house don't you get, Josie?
I'm sorry, she sobs. I'm so sorry.
For wearing your shoes in the house? Or for not telling me that you and Nolan were responsible for Daniel's death? I shout.
God, don't say that,
Josie says, her eyes filled with horror, her lower lip trembling.
Please, don't say that.
Well, I say. Let's look on the bright side. At least this makes my decision to divorce him a little easier. Meredith, don't. Don't let that happen to you. You love each other, she says, then launches into a rambling monologue about how this has affected her relationships, that she's been punishing herself for years, something about Will and their breakup, something about Gabe. I cut her off. Once again! I say, this is all about you, Josie. All about how Daniel's death affected you! No, she says.
I just don't want this to have an impact on your marriage, too.
Too late, I say.
I'm so sorry. He's so sorry, too. Can't you forgive us?
Talk to Daniel about forgiveness, Josie. Talk to God about that.
I have, she says. Which is a neat trick, since I'm pretty sure she's an atheist. How about Mom and Dad? I say. Do they know? She shakes her head. Think they'll forgive you? I say. Think Mom will be okay with this twist in the story? I don't know, she whimpers, her face red and blotchy and streaked with mascara. I hope she can forgive me. I hope Mom and Dad both can. Well, they just might, I say, my voice quivering as I hold back my own tears, determined not to cry until I'm alone. But I will never forgive you, Josie. Not for as long as I live.
Chapter 29, Josie. I stay on Ellen's sofa for a long time, nursing, then refilling my whiskey, reeling as I formulate a further plea for forgiveness. I know there is nothing that I can say or do that will change her mind about what I've done and what I've left undone for so long. She will only think me more selfish. It crosses my mind that maybe she is right, that this whole trip has been completely self-serving. But then I feel a flash of anger, realizing that there is so often a catch-22 with Meredith. Damned if I do, damned if I don't. I consider calling Nolan, if only to warn him, but worry that might make things worse, that will look even more conspiratorial. In fact, I have the feeling Meredith is more upset by the fact that we kept this secret than by what actually happened on that night. I try to imagine how I would feel if I suddenly learned that she and Gabe had been keeping a big secret from me. I can't deny how much it would hurt. And Gabe and I aren't even married. Then again, what if they were only trying to protect me? Would I give them a pass if that were the case? I tell myself I absolutely would, and nearly awaken Meredith to make this point. After all, wasn't she the one who suggested we not share details of our Sophie dinner with Mom? And wasn't that because she believes the information would only upset her? Isn't that what you do when you love someone? I start to work up some righteous indignation, but can't fully sell myself on the idea. Deep down, I know there's a difference between withholding information about our time with Sophie tonight and lying, even by omission, about the night Daniel died. There is simply no denying that I'm in the wrong. At some point I doze off. When I awaken, it's still dark outside, just after 4 o'clock. I decide I have to leave, that I can't face my sister in the morning. So I slip into Ellen's darkened bedroom, where Meredith is softly snoring, and I gather my things, shoving them haphazardly into my suitcase. As I turn to go, I remember the gift I brought for Meredith. Using the flashlight on my phone, I rifle through my bag and find the brand new, bright-eyed Rabby replacement, its fur still pristine and fluffy. I put it next to her pillow, then whisper goodbye to my sister, somehow understanding that this fight is different from all the others we've had. Although I hope I'm wrong, this one feels final. A few minutes later, I am in the back of a cab on the way to LaGuardia. There is no traffic, and we get there in record time. I pay my fare, then walk into the empty airport. A friendly lady at the Delta check-in counter reassures me that there are plenty of open seats on the 6 a.m. flight to Atlanta, and she feels sure I'll get one on standby. Good luck, dear, she says, giving me a look of pity, probably assuming that anyone who shows up at the airport hours before their scheduled flight is leaving under less than stellar circumstances. After I make it through security, I head for the restroom, where I brush my teeth and wash my face, calculating that I have over an hour until they start boarding that first flight to Atlanta. I head to the gate and curl up in a corner. My last thought as I pass out from exhaustion is how disgusting Meredith would think it to sit, let alone sleep, on the airport floor. I wake up with a whiskey headache, burning eyes, and a stiff neck, but feel a rush of relief when my name is called for the very last standby seat.
I take it as an omen, a sign that things can only get better from here.
Chapter 30. Meredith. They say you should never go to bed mad, but when it came to my fights with Josie, Mom always enforced the opposite. She'd send us to our respective rooms, insisting that we get some sleep, because things always look better in the morning. It was actually pretty sound advice, as we usually woke up and simply pretended that nothing had happened, before finding something new to argue about, of course. Occasionally, we'd even laugh it off, aligning ourselves against Mom and painting her as an overreactor. But around 4:30 in the morning, when I awaken and find that sad stuffed rabbit perched on my pillow, I do not feel even a tiny bit better. Instead, I feel considerably worse, just as angry and hurt, but also racked with guilt and worry, certain that my sister will be gone. Sure enough, I get up and look around the apartment, finding no trace of her, other than her shampoo on the edge of the bathtub, and one of her retro-striped tube socks peeking out from under the bed. I search the place one more time, hoping to find a note, if only to get the last word. But there is nothing. I pick up the rabbit and begin to panic, wondering where she could have gone in the middle of the night, whether she could be lying in a ditch somewhere. And although I can't imagine Josie ever harming herself, Lewis's sister does flit through my mind. So despite my resolution never to speak to her again, I call her cell. It goes straight to voicemail. I hang up without leaving a message, then get back in bed, still clutching the rabbit. I fall asleep for another couple of hours, then wake up, sweaty and weepy, piecing together a dream about Daniel. The first I've had in a long time, at least the first I can recall. The two of us were waiting on a subway platform together, talking and laughing, and then suddenly he vanished. Poof. Gone. For days, Josie, Mom, and I hung placards, plastering his face all over the city, like the ones posted after September 11th. But Daniel never turned up. Of course, it doesn't take an expert to decipher the nightmare, and I can clearly see that it stems from some combination of Josie leaving and Daniel dying, along with the grim thought of Lewis's sister plunging to her death on the subway tracks. I know it was just a dream, but I still start to worry that it is closer to a premonition than a nightmare, and ask myself what I would do if I never saw Josie again. Would I tell my mother about our fight? Or would I keep it a secret? History repeating itself. I get up, pacing frantically all over the apartment, searching for clues that don't exist before calling Josie a second time. Straight to voicemail again. I then call Delta, thinking and hoping that she simply got on an earlier flight, but they refuse to give out her information. I hang up and call them back, this time pretending to be Josie. I get flustered, then busted, then reprimanded about confidentiality. I really start to lose it, then decide to call Gabe, what feels like a last resort. "Hi," I say, bracing myself when he answers. "Is everything okay?" he asks, either clueless or in cahoots, both scenarios equally plausible. I answer the question with a question, asking if he's heard from Josie, determined not to be outwitted by someone I've always viewed as a worthy adversary. "No," he says. "I thought she was with you this weekend." "She was," I say, my hands turning clammy. "We had a fight last night. She left. I thought maybe she got on an earlier flight." "Not that I know of," he says, his voice completely flat. "I haven't heard from her." "Okay," I say. "Will you let me know if, when you do?" He hesitates, and it only takes 3 seconds for me to be pissed. "So I guess that's a no," I snap. "Never mind." "Jesus, Mayor, chill out," he says. "Chill out?" I yell into the phone. "She disappeared in the middle of the night, Gabe." "She's a big girl." "Yeah? Well, she told me about her big secret, I say, feeling sure Gabe knows everything. Silence. About the night Daniel died, I press. Okay, he says. Okay? That's it? That's all you have to say about my sister's role in my brother's death? I think that's a bullshit characterization, Meredith. You think it was okay to keep that secret from me? No, he says. And I'm glad she finally told you. 15 years late, don't you think? I don't think it's ever too late, actually, Gabe says, sounding all sanctimonious and superior and infuriatingly calm. But that's just me.
Easy for you to say, I scoff.
Maybe you'd feel differently if it were your brother who was killed, and your sister had kept a secret from you about the night he died.
Maybe I would, he says.
For 1 second, I'm nearly appeased until he snidely adds, Then again, Josie didn't keep the secret from me, now did she? What is that supposed to mean? I shout into the phone.
It means exactly what I said, Meredith. She told me everything years ago. She confided in me, not you. And I think there's a pretty good reason for that.
My mind races for a retort as he continues.
So maybe you should take a closer look at yourself and stop blaming Josie for everything.
You're a real asshole, I say, my face on fire. You know that?
Yeah, he says. But I'm the asshole who's always been there for Josie, which is more than I can say for you.
I hang up on him and throw the phone down, my hands shaking as I collapse onto the sofa and burst into tears. I cry as long and hard as I did when Daniel died, although the grief is obviously a different strain, more layered and complex. At some point, there are no more tears, but I stay put on the sofa, contemplating my life, how I got here. I think of Daniel's accident, of course, and my marriage to Nolan, and those years in between. I think of acting and law school, and parental expectations, and the home that has always been my home. I think of Josie, how fucked up our relationship is, and consider that maybe Gabe is right. Maybe it is my fault. Maybe I resent her because of my own choices. I think of Josie's theory that it's all interrelated, that it all goes back to that night in December, all of our decisions and dreams and mistakes from the past, inextricably linked. I consider calling Nolan, then my mother, then Ellen, then Amy, even my father. But I really don't want to talk to any of them, for different reasons. And it strikes me that I've never been so alone. And it is in this despondent, desperate moment that I think of the one person in the world whom I love without condition. The one part of this tragic story that is beautiful and perfect and untouched by regret or what-ifs. I am Harper's mother, I say aloud, feeling an incredible sense of peace wash over me. Then I stand and start to pack my things, finally ready to go home.
Chapter 31, Josie. A few hours later, I've landed in Atlanta and collected my bag and car. I drive home on a virtually empty highway, then pull up to my house, relieved not to see Leslie's car in the driveway.
Hey,
Gabe says, greeting me at the front door in flannel pajama pants and a t-shirt. He looks happy to see me, though not nearly as excited as Revis, who is planting his paws on my shoulders and licking my face. Hey, you two, I say, laughing as I hug Revis back.
I've been calling you,
Gabe says, pulling my bag off the porch and rolling it into the foyer. Yeah, my phone's dead, I say. I left my charger in New York.
Kiss it goodbye, he says, crossing his arms. She'll never give that back to you.
I raise my brows.
Meredith told you about our fight?
I ask, thinking that you can't really call it a fight. It was more of a one-sided falling out.
Yep, she called this morning looking for you.
I sigh and tell him that I left when she was still sleeping and got on an earlier flight. So what did Meredith say? I ask, sitting cross-legged on the floor with Revis, as Gabe takes a kitchen stool.
She's worried, he says.
I roll my eyes and mutter, yeah, right.
I promised to let her know when you turned up, so one of us should probably do that.
I shrug and tell him to feel free to text her, but that she made it very clear she doesn't want to hear from me ever again.
Well, she's pretty pissed at me, too, but I'll shoot her a text,
Gabe says, picking his phone up off the counter and starting to thumb type.
What's her beef with you?
I ask, rubbing the top of Revis's head, then his throat and belly.
I kind of went off on her, he says, still typing. Put her on a little guilt trip of her own.
I perk up a bit, feeling soothed by his loyalty.
And how did you manage to guilt Saint Meredith? I flipped the script on her sanctimony, he says. I told her that if she weren't so judgmental, maybe you would have confided in her years ago.
And, I ask, what did she say?
Oh, she heard me.
But did she back down?
A little, maybe.
He puts his phone down.
Besides, I'm sure she's way more upset at Nolan. I take it you told her that part of the story, too?
Yeah, I say, still feeling guilty about including Nolan in my confession, though there was really no other way to tell the truth. I had to.
Is he going to be angry with you?
I shrug, thinking that's the least of our concerns. I hope not. I'm going to text him what happened. Just give him a heads up. I'm sure he'll understand, and maybe even feel relieved. In any event, I know I did the right thing by telling her.
You did,
Gabe says, nodding.
I'm proud of you.
Thanks, I say with a big sigh. Then I tell him about our dinner with Sophie, sticking to the facts, that she married, had a son, then got a divorce, and is now in a relationship with a woman. I do not editorialize, wanting to hear his true reaction first.
Was it cathartic?
He asks, missing the mark, which is rare for him. I shake my head.
No,
I say.
The opposite.
Meredith and I both expected to see more grief, more longing. I think part of us, on some level, went into the night actually wanting to see a broken woman, wanting to hear that his death destroyed her life. My voice trails off as I silently finish my sentence, just as it did ours. Gabe stares at me for a few seconds, then shakes his head.
Nah, you wouldn't want that, he says. You just wanted to hear what he meant to her, that he affected her in some profound and lasting way.
I nod, thinking that this time he is right, and that really would have been enough. Yeah, true, I say, drawing a deep breath as I stand and take the stool next to his. So it wasn't cathartic, but I do feel a sense of closure.
On the Sophie front?
Yeah, and also with Meredith. I hope she comes around, but if she doesn't...
She will. She always does.
She might not this time. But either way, I did what I had to do, and I feel that I can now move on with my life. I'm ready to have a baby. Right now. Gabe turns 90 degrees on his stool, as I do the same, our shoulders now squared.
Right now, huh?
Yeah, I nod, feeling a rush of adrenaline as I hold his gaze. Right now. And with you, Gabe. I want to have this baby with you.
You do?
He says. His smile is faint, but his eyes are unmistakably happy. Yes, I do, I say, overwhelmed with a sense of calm certainty. If the offer's still good.
Yeah, Gabe grins. I think we're both a little nuts here. But yeah, the offer's still good.
Can you picture it? I ask him, because I'm finally really starting to. Not just motherhood, which I've been imagining in one way or another since I was a little girl playing with dolls, but a permanent partnership with Gabe, and the dark-haired, brown-eyed, brilliant child his genes will likely give me.
Yes, I can, actually, he says without any hesitation.
Really? I say, feeling a little choked up. He nods.
Yes, you're my best friend, Josie.
You're more than a best friend. I told you, you're my family.
You're my family, too, I say. I just want you to be sure.
I'm sure, he says. I'm sure that you're going to drive me crazy, and I'm sure this baby is going to kill my lifestyle. But I've given this a lot of thought, really since the first time you brought it up. And I'm also sure, very sure, that this will be the best thing I ever do with my life. That this baby will be everything to me, to both of us.
I break into a big grin, then give him an even bigger hug. As we separate, I tell him he's officially on the hook, no takebacks, and that I'll be calling Dr. Lazarus first thing tomorrow morning.
So how will this work exactly? Sydney asks me the following afternoon as we sit on our usual bench on the playground, supervising the kids during recess. I've just told her about the appointment I booked with Dr. Lazarus for later this week, and my decision to use Gabe's sperm.
Do you mean the actual procedure? I ask her.
Yeah. Will you have to do IVF?
No, I say. Not yet. My ovarian reserve is on the low side, but we decided to try one straightforward round of insemination first.
So no fertility drugs?
No, I say. Just an injection of HCG to trigger ovulation beforehand.
Then what?
That's pretty much it. Then we just wait and see what happens, I say, the weight of my decision sinking in more with every passing hour.
So no lawyers either? Like you were going to use with Pete?
Correct, I say, getting butterflies hearing Pete's name and thinking about our dinner plans tonight. I push him out of my mind and continue.
They just take the sample from Gabe, then wash and process it to basically concentrate the sperm and maximize the chances of conception. Then they just shoot it up there. It's a super easy procedure.
I pat my stomach and smile.
It's like a normal pregnancy, minus his penis inside me.
Oh yeah, so normal.
Sydney cracks up just as Edie runs over to our bench, calling my name in deep distress, as she does about twice a week.
Miss Josie! Miss Josie!
What's wrong, sweetie? I ask, pretending to be more alarmed than I am.
Wesley called me a dumb girl, she sobs, tears streaming down her face. He's so mean!
I put my arm around her and tell her what I believe to be true based on months of observation. Sweetie, Wesley teases you because he likes you.
No, he hates me, she insists,
as I catch Wesley over by the monkey bars, eyeing us with a mischievous smile.
Trust me, he likes you, I say, picturing the two of them one day dating and telling the story of how they met, back in the first grade in Miss Josie's class. Stranger things have happened.
And guess what? I continue in my most excited I have a big secret voice.
What?
She asks, wiping away her tears and looking at me with wide, trusting eyes.
I like you too, I whisper in her ear. A lot.
Edie's tears instantly clear. She gives me a big smile before scampering off happy again.
Teacher's pet, Sydney says, elbowing me.
Guilty, I say, smiling. She's just so sweet. Like her mother, actually.
Too bad her dad sucks, Sydney says.
I shrug, feeling blissfully indifferent to Edie's dad, then say, I don't know. Will's really not that bad. He's just a little lame. I'm glad I'm not married to him.
Wow, you really have made progress, Sid says.
Yeah, I guess I have, I say, thinking of what a strange but powerful turn my life has taken since the first day of school, back when I feared Edie, despised Will, and pinned all my hopes on some man I might never meet. A couple of hours before our reservation at Soto Soto, my favorite Italian restaurant in Atlanta, Pete calls me, asking if he can come pick me up. I tell him I appreciate the offer, but that it makes no sense for him to drive all the way to Buckhead when he lives in Inman Park, so near the restaurant.
How about I pick you up? I say.
He starts to protest, insisting that he doesn't mind the driving, but I cut him off and say, when will you learn you're not dealing with a traditional girl here?
Pete laughs.
Okay, good point. Do you want to come early for a drink?
Sure, I say. 7?
Perfect. 87 Druid Circle, just past Krog Street Market.
I scribble the address on a notepad and say, got it. See you soon.
Can't wait, Pete says.
A few minutes past 7, I am standing on the front porch of Pete's charming craftsman bungalow, ringing his bell. The door swings open immediately, and there he stands, looking cuter than ever. Hi, I say, smiling.
Hi, you.
He smiles back at me, then steps aside, holding the door.
You look beautiful.
Thank you, I say, stepping inside. He gives me a hug. I can't tell if he's wearing cologne or if it's just soap, but I love his scent. You smell nice, I tell him as we separate. And I like your hair.
Are you being sarcastic?
He says, running one hand through it, looking endearingly self-conscious.
I actually meant to get a haircut today.
No, I really like it, I say. I like a little longer hair on guys.
On guys, huh?
Pete says teasingly. On you, I clarify. He smiles and thanks me, then leads me to his kitchen, where a very basic plate of cheese, crackers, and green grapes awaits us.
Can I get you something to drink? A glass of wine? A beer?
I'd love a beer, I say, sitting at his small round table. I watch him pull 2 Sweetwater beers out of the fridge. He opens them, then pours them into chilled mugs from the freezer. He hands me mine, then sits beside me.
So how was your day?
He says. I give him the highlights, as well as a few trivial lowlights, then ask about his day. He reports that it was great, then tells me an inspiring story about one of his favorite clients, a high school tailback recovering from a torn meniscus. As he talks, it occurs to me that I've never seen him in a bad mood.
So, what did you want to talk to me about?
He asks. I look at him, confused, and he quickly clarifies.
When you were in New York, you told me you had something you wanted to talk about?
Oh, right, I say, stalling, thinking about how long ago that phone call seems. Although, part of me wants to tell him everything, right at this moment, with no filter whatsoever. Another greater part of me simply wants to go to dinner with the guy I like. It was a couple of different things, actually, but we can talk about that stuff later, I say, glancing at my watch. Should we head out?
Sure, he says. Are you driving?
Yep, I say, smiling.
You opening my car door, too?
I laugh and say, absolutely. 2 hours later, after a light-hearted, yet still romantic dinner, I pull back up to the curb in front of Pete's house and put my car in park. Thank you for a wonderful evening, and thank you for dinner, I say.
It was my pleasure,
he says, biting his lower lip as he shoots me a serious glance.
Can you come in for a minute? I promise, I won't keep you long. I know you have to get up early.
I hesitate, feeling torn. As much as I want to end the evening on an easy high note and delay the inevitable for just a little bit longer, I know this isn't fair to Pete. He deserves the truth. So, with a sinking feeling in the pit of my stomach, I nod and say, okay, I can come in for a few minutes. We get out of my car and walk back to his front door, our shoulders touching as he unlocks it. Once inside, he instantly takes me in his arms, and I can't resist the amazing warm feel of him against me. My heart races with attraction and anticipation as our foreheads touch, then our cheeks and noses. I hold my breath as his lips brush against mine, and he whispers that this is our official first kiss, not the one at Johnny's. My heart breaks a little as I think, more likely, that it is our last. I make myself pull back and say his name.
Yes,
he says, staring intently into my eyes. Can we sit for a minute and talk? He nods and says, of course, then leads me into his living room, filled with Packers memorabilia and framed photos of his family. All as happy, wholesome, and Midwestern-looking as he. We sit beside each other on the sofa, and he takes my hand. So, I did want to talk to you about some things, I say,
my heart pounding with so many competing, overwhelming emotions. I can feel him staring.